Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Matter, the SLAS podcast where we interview life science luminaries. I'm your host, Hannah Rosen, and today we will be continuing our series on career trajectories. Our guest is Rupert Dodkins, AI engineer and data scientist at Vicky Inc. Thank you for joining us today, Rupert.
Good afternoon, Hannah. Thank you for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. So since this is a podcast focusing on career trajectories, we always like to start this series off by asking you where all good careers start. And so, you know, when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Yeah, I actually have quite a wholesome story. So when I was little, maybe six or seven, I went to this huge 250-foot radio telescope in England called Jodrell Bank. I'm not sure why it's called that. I guess British people love having silly names for places. But I remember being awestruck at how massive this thing is. And so at the end of the tour, I got these glow-in-the-dark stars, and those ended up on my bedroom ceiling. And so these stars from that observatory would be the last thing that I'd see every night before I went to sleep. And so because of that, that kind of set me off on this first trajectory of my life that was wanting to build stuff for space. What's actually really cool is I actually ended up doing my master's degree at the university that owned that site with the telescope and used that telescope site for my research. I mean, they didn't let us use the big 250-foot monster that's, historic, but, it was pretty cool to go back to that site and complete the circle.
That's so amazing. And I've had a similar experience when I was a kid of, going someplace where it's just like, this is amazing and I can't imagine. And then you come back there as a professional adult and get to, actually work there. It is just like, it's a trip. It's just so surreal when that happens. Yeah. But I think that that's so cool because, when I was a kid, I think a lot of us had those glowy stars on the ceiling of our bedrooms. And it's interesting that yours, you kept going with it. It really sparked a passion. Do you know, what was it about those stars that kind of had sparked that passion for you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think it is just sort of like, I don't know, it's just like, it's so like almost subconscious the way that these things end up. You're sort of like predetermined. I wonder like if somebody had put, if I'd gone on a trip and there had been like dinosaurs in my bed, maybe like I would end up being a, whatever the word for people who study dinosaurs are at this point. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, the stars kind of set off the track. At that point, I also got model rockets and there was like these planetarium little toys that everyone bought. So it all kind of falls into place. It all kind of, you get one ball rolling and then it all just kind of rolls after that.
Yeah. It does seem to be, it's not the first time I've heard that on this podcast of somebody saying like, it was kind of a right place, right time sort of thing. If somebody had handed me something else, like maybe that's where the interests would have gone. And so it is interesting just kind of highlighting how there's such crucial time periods in our lives where it really dictates what your interests are going to be going forward.
Right. Yeah, completely.
So did you have, or do you currently have anyone in your life who then significantly guided you or impacted your career trajectory?
That's a good question. So I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my mother, who's always been very encouraging at every step of the way. Apart from her, I have to tell you about someone called Brian Cox. So, do you know who Carl Sagan is?
Of course.
Okay, great. Okay, so imagine him, but equally beautiful way with words about space, equally inspiring, but with a funny Northern British accent. So this guy's actually really interesting. He took time away from his physics career to play the keyboard for a pretty successful glam / pop rock band before eventually returning back to his roots to become a professor at Manchester University. And so I remember at the time, I'm about 18 years old studying for my exams to go to this university where he teaches, right? He's regarded as one of the best schools at the time to do what I wanted to do. And I was so desperate to get in. And I'm the kind of person who gets really anxious even weeks before an exam. But at the time, Professor Cox's TV show is on the TV, Wonders of the Solar System. And so I'm watching him illustrate these phenomena so clearly. And it was just really exciting and really empowering for me to hear that. And so that's really what helped me pass those exams and get into that school.
Wow. Yeah. Did you get to meet him when you attended that school?
Yeah. You know what's actually really funny is, so the year that I started, he took a year out to whatever these celebrity scientists do. And so I missed the course that he teaches for first years. But I had some good friends the next year who did have him, so I would just sneak into his class and just go attend their lectures.
I admit that I did that as well when I was doing my PhD at Stanford. There was a professor there, Robert Sapolsky, who I really admired and taught a course for undergrads. And I just like every day I would sneak in and just like, I'm just going to audit this course just so I can, yeah, experience that.
That is pretty funny. I also have to tell you about somebody who I did get to meet. So for the PhD, I went to another institution at Oxford. And so it's someone who went there is Jocelyn Bell Burnell. And she's this lady who famously discovered pulsars, these sort of zombie stars that act like lighthouses with radio jets that hit the earth. And so so she's awesome. So she, crazy side story is that, you know, her supervisor, her male supervisor is the one who got the Nobel Prize for that discovery. Naturally. Unfortunately. Right. Of course. Yeah. Back in the day. But yeah, so she's since won every other award you can imagine. And, you know, she's got like five titles after her name, which must be really inconvenient if she has to write that out all the time. But yeah, so she was at Oxford University researching, and she also went to school with my aunt. And so when I heard about that, I was like, man, I've got to at least apply to this university. And so what's really cool is that I actually ended up, obviously got in, and I actually ended up having an office just down the hall from her. So I did get to meet her like most days.
Oh, that's awesome. What was that like?
Oh, it's cool. I mean, I'm kind of the person who gets very like starstruck. So I guess just really inspiring to see someone like that. She's very humble, which is awesome.
That's great. Cause you know, they say don't meet your heroes, but sometimes it works out, and that's really good to hear that it did work out for you.
Yes.
Well, that's awesome. So, you know, kind of going back a little bit then, you know, what was your college experience like? Did you do research while you were an undergrad? Did you have a mentor while you were in college?
Yeah, so I was actually very studious, which I think is part of the reason I had such close relationships with staff at both undergrad and PhD. So, for example, while most students were out doing the traditional undergraduate thing of like drinking games in the halls of residence, me and my friends were having a drink at the pub with one of the maths and astrophysics professors. This is like undergrad, right? So most people don't really hang out with their professors. Similarly for the PhD, you know, those of us in the instrumentation department, that's what I did, would often spend like several nights a week at the pub talking about everything, which is really cool because like you can learn a lot from someone at that level in academia. You can learn like, you know, academia politics, the politics of academia. So I've always tried to get as much insight as I can from these mentors, you know, like figuring out how they think has been really important to me. But yeah, and also just to answer your question about research too, I did a summer internship in my undergrad, and that was at my school. And then that allowed me to do a summer internship at Space Telescope Science Institute, which is this place in Baltimore where they do the science for the Hubble Space Telescope and now for the James Webb Space Telescope. And yeah, well, with that, that was pretty cool. It wasn't so much instrumentation focus, which is what I want to do, but it was like a highly prestigious position that I could learn a ton from. And it was in America, which is another dream of mine. And so, yeah, that coupled with the research I did during my master's degree at that big telescope place I told you about before, that was what allowed me to get into a good school for a PhD.
Nice. So I'm curious about, you know, all that time that you spent with your professors outside of school. Did you feel like, did it provide you with any sort of advantages when it came then to applying to grad school or networking to get a job after you finish your degree?
It absolutely did. I mean, so they were quite professional in their regard towards not revealing too much about how they could help us, but the sort of insight that they were able to give me in terms of how the field worked was like really, you know, unique, I guess. Like there was a lot to learn about how these things work. I mean, certainly, as you say, like it's not about what you know, it's about who you know. And so certainly that helped. I was able to meet the people that I did my postdocs. I'm now in California. And the way I got here was that I worked with someone who was previously a research assistant at the university where I did my postdoc. And so, yeah, you know, it's all about these connections. You don't know where things are going to go, but at some point, you know, you meet people and they know people, and that's how these positions are found.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's great. And I think that that goes to show, you know, it's not always about, you know, you're not sitting there pumping your professor for the test answers or something, but sometimes getting that inside scoop into how academia functions can be just as valuable.
Yeah, exactly.
So what made you then decide to pursue a master's and then eventually your PhD?
Personally, I'm pretty bad at making decisions. I'm the kind of person who will be at a restaurant and instantly regret the thing that I've ordered. But with the master's and the PhD, it was like unequivocally the right choice for me at the time. I'd always wanted to build stuff for space, and PhD and master's was the first real opportunity to do that. But not only that, it was like, it's the vital step, stepping stone on being a path to work at a postdoc or a national lab. Yeah, it was an obvious choice for me.
Yeah. So it was one of those things where you knew where you wanted to end up and you knew what you needed to do to get there.
Right. Exactly. I was very privileged in that sense. I know like a lot of people like don't have that sort of direction in their lives, but for me, it's very easy and I really appreciated it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. I mean, I myself am very jealous of having that mindset of knowing exactly where you want to go with your career and then just, yeah, like, okay, here are all the steps laid out. I just need to check them all off.
Right. But I mean, having said that, I'm now not in space and I'm now like a life scientist, AI researcher. So it is kind of funny how it's kind of like a blessing and a curse in a way, because you have this, you know, really rock solid plan that you worked towards for years, and then you reach the goal and you're like, wow, okay, like I've worked this for so long, I've achieved my dream, like now what? And so that can be kind of sort of like a, you know, existential crisis at that point. But yeah, it's, you know, there's always sort of skills that you learn at each step of the way, and you figure out new ways that you can apply those to better serve whatever it is that you're trying to achieve. And so, yeah, I think it's important for me, at least, to have a destination that you want to reach and then just taking steps towards it.
Yeah. So when you were looking at graduate school programs, you had in mind this career path of, I'm going to do my PhD, I'm going to get a postdoc, and then I'm going to work for a national laboratory. Was that kind of what you had in mind as the end goal?
Exactly. Yep.
So then how did you, you know, when you had this long-term vision in mind, how did you go about choosing where you wanted to apply and which graduate program seemed like the best fit for you?
My guiding compass was always which place had the highest academic merit by my perception. There were some PhDs in the United States, but a 7-year degree sounded too long for my taste. Oxford and Cambridge were both doing pretty great work on my field, which is exoplanet instrumentation. So I tossed between those two. But honestly, like Oxford just had the better, honestly, like the more welcoming vibe. It's kind of funny to say that like that had such a big impact for me, but like it really did. I mean, like, you know, you're working with these people for 4 years, you want to be kind of close to them. And so that allowed me to foster those sort of relationships that I spoke out before about, you know, going to the pub with these guys. And yeah, and also, you know, the Oxford project did allow me to do that work that allowed me to make that jump to the United States, which was always a sort of a goal of mine.
Yeah, I think that that is something that can often be overlooked, though, really, is that feeling of it being a good fit for you as well. Like, it's not just about, you know, are they doing the cutting edge research? Are they doing the, you know, you want it to, because you're going to be spending a lot of time there and you want to be in an environment that's going to foster your academic spirit, I guess, so to speak, and not crush it, which I know is common with a lot of the more competitive labs, at least in the United States, is you get a very competitive atmosphere, which doesn't really foster success, in my personal opinion.
No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, the sort of collaboration is like so, so important. The fact that we can all sort of build on each other's ideas. This sort of competition can be good in some aspects, but I think when it comes to academia, like the more sharing of ideas, the better, in my opinion, for the greater common good.
Absolutely. Looking back, do you have any regrets of how you went about choosing your graduate school experience? And do you wish that there were any other factors you had considered when deciding where to apply or where to attend?
That's a good question. I'm pretty happy with my choice. I mean, honestly, like when the Oxford result came in, it was the top choice school that I was applying to. I mean, I had Cambridge too, but Oxford, you know, these people were a lot more friendly. And so that was kind of my top choice. And so when the result came in, you know, I was in my lab with my lab partner, and the result came in, we opened it together, and I was surrounded by 40 of the students, so I couldn't lose my mind at that point. But I do remember I like excused myself and I like briskly walked out the building, and then I literally started doing cartwheels out the door. Literally. Yeah. So I was pretty excited to get that result. It just seemed like the obvious choice for me at the time. Yeah, there's probably not much I would have changed regarding that.
Well, that's great. Glad to hear that it you know, worked out and you're still happy with that decision in the long term.
Yeah, actually, I would say real quick that I think what's beautiful about physics and experimentation in general is that it is very applicable to lots of different areas. So even though I now do life sciences and AI, the skills I learned were just like so transferable. I really did just, you can't make a mistake doing a degree in physics and experimentation.
It's a good insight, I think, for sure. But so speaking of that, you know, what you've mentioned that you have made quite the change in what you thought your ultimate career path would be when you first started out. What brought you to end up making that change?
Leaving academia and also parting with space were kind of two sides of the same coin for me. And I guess if there is one constant in my life, is that I've wanted to work on meaningful projects that I think can make a difference. And the thing about academia, at least in astrophysics, I can't comment on life science as much, but in astrophysics, academia, it's, you're on the cutting edge and you are kind of pushing the envelope of knowledge, but there's less focus on products that can directly help people. Mm. Yeah, I kind of see like academics as the people at the front of the pack, like with the machetes, cutting through the brush and exploring new ground, whereas kind of I'd like being the people behind that, like building stuff on the ground behind them. Does that make sense?
That's a great analogy, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I think both roles are important, but I'd rather, I've learned that I value seeing more immediate results.
Mm. So what do you do now at Vicky Inc. and how does that sort of fulfill that need you felt for the more immediate results?
Yeah. So I'm very fortunate to work at this AI and image processing company called Vicky. And it's a really small startup with this powerful platform for creating any sort of solution for image processing that people may have. And, you know, they don't work on environmental science with satellite images, their population changes because of like tourists coming and taking pictures, marine life. And so, and the company has this great culture of caring about and tackling problems with a good societal value. And so I primarily work on this really cool algorithm that expedites this one measurement that happens all the time in virology research, which is an infectivity assay. Basically, like, you're counting the amount of infectious viruses in cell monoculture. It's, you know, you have to do it a lot, like when developing vaccines or antivirals. And yeah, so it's this really cool algorithm because we basically apply AI to these images and we're able to measure the amount of infectious viruses in these cells by just looking at the normal microscope images. There's no fluorescence going on. And it's a lot quicker and less objective, and you don't have to deal with these primitively complex staining of cells. So it's like a really rewarding project for me because it's like literally like, this is stuff that I can see it being applied by other research groups and speeding up their research and having this really like transformative impact. And so they can create more products as opposed to what I was doing before, which was like detecting exoplanets. And I mean, like, that's cool, right? Maybe like my great grandkids might be able to go to a planet that's 10 light years away, but that's a bit indirect benefit, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I can definitely relate to that for sure. And I think probably a lot of people listening will be able to relate to that sentiment as well. Yeah. Was it difficult for you when you decided that you wanted to make the transition from, you know, astrophysics into life sciences? Did you have a hard time kind of getting a foot in the door with life science companies, or were you able to sell your skill set in a way that they immediately saw your value?
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned I was very fortunate to work at this company called Vicky. And that's because, as I said, yeah, my background is astrophysics. Right? I obviously had AI experience in image processing. And so in a way, the skills are quite transferable. Yeah, I think you do just kind of have to sell yourself as someone who's quick to learn and then you're good, right? Yeah, it wasn't terribly I didn't have too much of an issue making the transition. But I do think you have to find the right company who's willing to be patient with you as you mm-hmm. as you learn how sales work and all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to shift gears slightly, because I understand that you jointly hold the world record for the most skateboard heel flips in 1 minute, which is quite an interesting achievement. So can you tell us a little bit about that? You know, like, how did you achieve this world record, and what led you to want to attempt a world record in the first place?
Yeah, it's pretty random, huh? So basically, it's funny. I started skateboarding when I was 8, as a lot of 8-year-olds do, I guess. And I would practice this thing for hours every day. And you know, it's amazing how engaging this thing is, like learning these new tricks on this plank of wood with the rails. Like, you can do it by yourself, or you can be at a skate park with friends. Like, even like a slight slope or a couple stairs makes adds a whole new dimension to this sport. So I was really engaged with this for 10 years, 12 years. I must have invested about 10,000, 15,000 hours of my life into this thing. And so fast forward to me as a PhD student, I'm 23 years old, haven't properly skateboarded in years. And then one day, for some reason, I'm looking at the list of Guinness World Records for most number of X trick in a minute. So it's like kickflips, or most number of ollies in a minute. These are all tricks that are rudimentary tricks on a skateboard that all tricks are built off of. And actually, funny enough, Rob Dyrdek actually owns a lot of these world records. Have you heard of Rob Dyrdek?
Yeah, the name sounds familiar. Can you refresh all of the listeners?
Yeah, he's this TV personality. He's obviously a professional skateboarder, but he's had TV shows where he's hosted this TV show called Ridiculousness, and he's had people follow him around and record his daily life on the show called Robin Big. So he's a professional TV personality, and he has all these world records. Yeah, anyway, so that's just kind of a random fact, but so I'm looking at this list of records, some of them owned by Rob Dyrdek, and I'm thinking to myself, I can actually probably beat these, or at least like I could have back in the day. And so I think to myself, well, I could probably relearn these tricks pretty quick. Why don't I just choose one? So the most heel flips in a minute was slightly less than the most number of kick flips in a minute. They're basically the same trick. So I'm like, okay, heel flips it is. Let's choose that one. So I practiced this trick over and over and over again. I'm waking up early. I'm going to like car parks. I obviously can't practice this thing in my backyard because I live next to grad students, and it's pretty loud to practice this thing. So I drive them nuts. And so I'm like going to car parks in the morning and practice this thing like it's like I've got some competition coming up. And like, no skateboarder does this. It's doing one trick over and over again. It's like, it kind of goes against the creative expression associated with the sport. So I'm a bit bonkers for doing this, but it's all for Guinness World Record, because I think, why not? So for a bit of context, in order to get a Guinness World Record, you either have to pay them a lot of money to have someone come out who's like an official for them and they can verify it for you, or you can organize this committee of people, and this event complete with local media to come and cover the event. You have to have people to video, take pictures, and you also have to have independent professional experts come and verify it for their domain. So for example, I have to have two independent professional skateboarders verify that the tricks were correct, you know, make sure I wasn't cheating. And I even had to have someone who was somehow qualified in using a stopwatch. And so I guess, yeah. So I went to the local Oxford track, and one of the athletes kindly agreed to push this button for me a few times on the day.
That's so
funny. So anyway, right. that one especially is kind of funny to me. But anyway, so we've organized this event. I've got these tricks down to pure muscle memory at this point, because which is perfect, because like I'm kind of a nervous person. My heart is racing on the day. So thankfully it's all muscle memory at this point. And so I'm performing in front of all these people. They don't want to waste their time. But thankfully it all comes together. And you know, the videos did the job, the professional skateboarders counted it. And I'm just super grateful for everyone who came and cheered me on and collected evidence for the Guinness World Records, all from their goodwill. But the funny thing about how much effort it takes to organize this thing is that the record isn't actually really that hard to beat. Anyone who's a professional skateboarder could probably beat it. But the overlap of people who are both able to beat it and care enough to actually go to all this effort to organize the event, like the, you know, the Venn diagram is like the slither of those two overlapping circles, really tiny. Probably it's just me and Rob Dyrdek. But yeah, it's great, because to this day, no one's beat it.
That's amazing. So would you do it again, do you think?
I think Yeah, I mean, now that the pressure's off, I wouldn't mind having another go at beating it, because obviously I drew him. I mean, but the professional skateboarders who were there qualifying, we all agreed I got 17, but then two got knocked off. So I have this conspiracy theory that Rob paid Guinness World Records behind the scenes, or talks to people, pulls some strings. But no, I would love to do it again. I haven't skateboarded even more time. So, I mean, I still do. I still use it to like get around, but yeah, it would take me a lot of practice to be able to get back up to that level again.
That's funny. Maybe you can create a new world record, which is the most skateboard heel flips with the longest amount of time since you've last been on a skateboard.
Yeah, right. Perfect. Yeah, I wonder what the rules are for like how obscure the record could be.
Yeah, because it sounds like you could probably get some pretty obscure records going for that.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. So, you know, I'm kind of wondering, this drive that you had to create this or beat this world record, do you feel like, do you see that same drive in your career? Has that kind of been a carryover into your experiences as a scientist?
Yeah, exactly. You draw from the same pool of motivation. And anyone can set their mind to anything can achieve most things if they really try. And so that was kind of what helped me, was treat it like it is a job or like a competition. And it's funny because that's kind of how it has ended up being. I mean, I didn't plan for it to be like this. I just thought it'd be cool to be able to brag about this. But it's the hilarious thing is, as has actually ended up being, this world record thing has ended up having more impact on my career than any one talk or exam I ever took, which is, it's kind of funny. People really appreciate it. Like, I think people really like the juxtaposition of a adult scientist who's also like a hardcore skateboarder on the side.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it kind of breaks that traditional idea you have of somebody who would, you know, be an astrophysicist or, yeah, working in AI and life sciences. It is. It subverts expectations, which people always love.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it was literally one of the first things people said when I did this internship in Baltimore. It was, you know, it was 14 of us new summer interns, and the mentors were there. We're all sat in a group. And first thing someone says is, all right, which one of you guys does the skateboarding?
So maybe that's another lesson, is anything, whatever sets you apart from the crowd is always going to be a benefit. Well, maybe not always. A good thing. It has to be a good thing that sets you apart from the crowd, not a bad thing.
Right. Maybe any publicity is good publicity, you know?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I don't advocate.
Did you take any lessons from that whole experience of beating this world record and then apply those to how you approach your career?
Yeah. It is just like a lot of transferable skills, being able to organize events. I mean, that you know, we all do that in our jobs. Well, yeah, very often we're organizing stuff like that. Yeah, it was a lot of coordination, which is, I guess, kind of similar to what it would be to organize collaborations in our careers. But yeah, I just think the idea of like setting aside time to do something, to get the reps in, that's obviously very useful.
So on a broader scale, you know, now that you've had a kind of a career in astrophysics, and then you have a new career kind of, or an extension of that career in the life sciences. So I'm curious, how do you personally identify or define success in whatever field you've chosen?
I think obviously we all have our own idea of success. I've always traditionally defined it based on what the best school and grades I could achieve that would allow me to achieve a certain position. But I think if you define success as reaching a destination, you're in for a bad time, similar to how I became a professional instrument scientist for space. And then I kind of struggled with the lack of purpose at the time. So I think as long as you're clear with what you're trying to achieve and taking honest steps to achieve it, then I think that's success on a personal level.
Well, we are almost out of time here. Is there anything that you want to add that we didn't get a chance to talk about?
Well, I mean, just real quick, if I may, I do think it's really cool what SLAS is doing, focusing on automation of labs. I think, like, I mean, I alluded to this earlier, but I do think that the idea of automating processes, which allow us to sort of make them more repeatable, and you know, if people take the configurations of their experiments and upload them to open source, places. I think it's great because it makes them more repeatable, makes them more verifiable, and allows us to all kind of build on each other's research, which is really exciting for me. So I just think that's really cool.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Thank you for that feedback. We appreciate it. Well, and you know what, Rupert, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you and learn more about your personal journey to get to where you are. And I think that both myself, some of our SLAS staff who I know have been kind of fanboying over you since we heard about your your world record. I won't mention any names, but and I'm sure a lot of our members are going to look forward to seeing you at more SLAS events in the future.
Thank you, Hannah. Thank you for having me.